Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Welcome to Face to Face. This is a show about change and about what's next. It's a show that wants to ask questions, peel back the layers of our average everyday experience, and go beyond scratching the surface. We interview amazing people with incredible ideas and stories who have done wild, weird, and wonderful things. Remember that imagination shared creates collaboration, and collaboration creates community, and community inspires social change. I'm David Peck, and this is Face to Face.
So my next interview is with Professor Alexander Hinton. He's the author of a book that I've read recently called Why Did They Kill Cambodia and the Shadow of Genocide. He's got a new book coming out in October that I think you really need to look for. He's an anthropologist. He's a genocide scholar. He's a writer. He's a thinker. He's a man of great passion as well. And we talk about a lot of things in this interview that I think you're going to find very interesting. And I think for me, one of the threads that runs throughout is just this idea of, I guess you could say, of community, of others, of relationship. This, one of the things that he talks about is how, you know, genocide comes out of this notion of our positive identity being predicated on somebody else's negative identity. And that's a Peckian paraphrase there. I hope it teases out. But I think there's a lot here to take away from this interview. And I highly recommend the book. But again, this idea of inclusion versus exclusion is something that clearly was a theme in my interview with Alex, and a real thrill for me to have him on the show. DavidPeckLive.com. Don't forget to check it out for more interviews. And my book, Real Change is Incremental, is available through Amazon.ca. Stay tuned for Professor Alexander Hinton. Well, welcome to Face to Face. We're joined by a very special guest today, and I'm absolutely thrilled to have him on the show with us today. Professor Alexander Hinton is here. He's the director of the Center for the Study of Genocide and Human Rights, and he's a professor of anthropology and global affairs at Rutgers University in Newark. He's also the past president of the International Association of Genocide Scholars and holds the UNESCO chair in genocide prevention. Thanks for joining us today, Alex. I really appreciate you coming along on the show.
Well, thanks so much for inviting me.
So it sounds like is this going to be like a really funny interview? There's going to be a lot of comedy in this one, Alex. When I read your bio, it sure doesn't sound like it.
Well, so sometimes people who work in the field of genocide studies have sometimes bits of humor that appear, but I don't think that'll most likely be the case, unfortunately.
No, probably not. And I do think I want to ask you at some point about, and maybe we could roll with this, but how does somebody actually say, you know, here, that's something I want to study? And then I think really what I wonder, you know, family, friends, how does somebody working in this kind of a field recharge? But let's get back to that. Tell me a bit about your work. You're the author of a book that I have read that is fantastic, by the way. Why Did They Kill? Subtitled Cambodia in the Shadow of Genocide. You have a new book coming out. Maybe you could tell us about that. Man or Monster, The Trial of a Khmer Rouge Torturer. I think it's coming out in October of this year. How do you get into this kind of work?
That's a great question. Maybe we can go back to when I was in graduate school studying anthropology at Emory University. in the early 1990s, and at that time, the UN had just arrived in Cambodia following the Paris Peace Accords, and there was a mission. Elections were held in 1993. But as a when I first arrived at graduate school in 1990, I knew I wanted to work in Asia, and I knew I wanted to do something that involved Buddhism, and I narrowed it down to Tibet and Cambodia. And then because of the political situation, you know, Cambodia began to open up. Tibet still today remains very difficult in that regard.
Right.
So I went to Cambodia as a graduate student in 1992. I'd begun some language training, and I lived there. But when I first went there, you know, I didn't have the intention of studying genocide. I was going to study local understandings of psychology. Maybe trauma as an issue would be involved as well. But there's a field of folk psychology, but sort of local understandings of emotion, self, affect. Anyway, so that's what I arrived with. But while I was there, you know, people began to tell us stories. When I first arrived in Cambodia the first week, on the way to the university, I was taking Khmer lessons. I passed by a woman who had been shot in the head and was lying in a pool of blood. Wow. Guns were fired off. You know, so the very first week itself, the issue of violence was very much in front of me. I looked up at different buildings, you could see bullet holes in the walls. You know, the landscape there in lots of different ways, you know, links into the history of violence, ranging from craters in the paddy fields, from the bombing of B-52s, to just little things you notice, like those bullet holes in the walls, or the fact that at the time, almost everybody had a handgun. Once I was with another scholar who had a research assistant, I was talking. I said, "Oh yeah, a lot of people seem to have guns." And the research assistant suddenly pulled out a handgun.
Well, well, you were still. I mean, we were still in the in Cambodia civil war, really, right? Up until what, 97? You could say there was still fighting going on in various parts of the country.
Yeah, one person said the 30 years war in Cambodia. You know, that goes back to 1967 up into the late 1990s. So the civil war was ongoing, but my, you know, sort of the moment that catalyzed my interest, if there, you know, you think of there are a number of different things, but one thing that's always stuck out is when I lived with the family, and remember one night, sometimes when you were there, electricity was very erratic, and the light would go out, and people would just keep talking, and one night I was with this family, and suddenly the lights went out, and the father just started talking out of the blue about his experiences. He had been a former Khmer Republic soldier, and he had been sent for re-education and suffered greatly, but he started telling the story in the dark. And, you know, I actually, oddly, had this experience several times while I was there. And so over time, you know, I heard these stories. People would often say, why did Cambodians kill Cambodians? Why did Khmer kill Khmer? And in a way, that question became my question, the question I pursued. And I, so I really, I didn't come into it with an interest in the Holocaust, the Armenian genocide, or violence in general. But it was the experience of being in Cambodia in 1992 that really crystallized that entrance, and in some sense led to the path that I took to get to where I am today.
Alex, do you think if you'd gone to Rwanda, do you think if you'd gone to Bosnia or you know, another place where, you know, these same sort of acts of violence had similar history, you know, because obviously, you know, as it comes out in your book, there are definitely links and there are connecting points historically. Do you think you would have had a similar experience, or do you think you could say on some level that one domino, that one, you know, ripple in the splash and ripple effect was that father telling you the story in the dark?
Yeah, you know, it's hard to know. This was 92, so we're just moving into 93 and 94. You know, the Cold War was ending. The UN had this new mission of optimism. Belief in the possibilities of UN peacekeeping, you know, eventually transitional justice is what people began to speak of. And so it was really a moment of optimism. I think in anthropology as well, for many years, people had not studied mass violence in any form. There's virtually nothing done on the Holocaust. So within the discipline, there's not that much of a focus on this. So I think that, you know, for me, that experience was very important. Though I should note that, as well, there were anthropologists who went to Bosnia and went to Rwanda in the mid-1990s, and this issue sort of picked up steam. And so there are a handful of other scholars who've right. studied genocide as well, a number of other anthropologists. So who knows? Maybe I would have gone down that path. Maybe I would have studied some other inflection. But for me, it was that question that they were asking,
right.
you know, why did Cambodians kill Cambodians? And, you know, that's the title of my book, Why Did They Kill? Because that's the question people ask.
So it's the kingdom of wonder. You know, you've got such a long history. You've got the Buddhist angle, the spiritual angle. You've got the violence angle, the colonization of the country, the beauty of the country, the people, and so on. I mean, I visited many, many times, as my listeners will know. I do work in the country, so I get some of that. Do you feel that, sure, you're a scholar, you're a writer, you're an author, you're researching, you're contributing in that sense. However, I get the sense from you too have sort of been bitten by that kingdom of wonder bug. Is that a fair assessment?
No, absolutely. Some people, a number of people have talked about this, that once you go to Cambodia, you can never, in a sense, leave. It's very difficult to leave, and people go back again and again. It's an amazing place, and it's also changed dramatically over the last 20, 25 years. But I'm sure it's a place, you know, I have interest in other localities as well, but I think I will continue for many more years to continue going back to Cambodia, even as I write on different topics. But more recently, with the tribunal that's being held there, my interests have shifted somewhat to the aftermath and the trials that have been going on. In the book you mentioned before, the trial of Doik, who ran a interrogation security center where many people were tortured, and then virtually everyone was killed. And he was the first one to be put on trial at the Khmer Rouge Tribunal. So the second book, well, the book most recently that I've been writing is Manor Monster, looks at his trial, the meaning of justice in Cambodia, but also it's very much about how we see someone like him, and that's where the title comes from. You know, man or monster.
Well, and Doik is a guy who's been now, he's now in prison. He's now serving time for his crimes. He's a guy who was sort of in hiding, found up north, Anlong Vang, northwestern sort of Cambodia, was he not? And suggests that he had a conversion experience of some kind.
That's right.
Yeah, yeah. So people might know about him. I mean, he was sort of in the press for a little while, and it's spelled D-U-C-H, correct?
That's his alias.
Yeah, his alias, right. So Alex, tell me something. You know, just in the title alone, and there's so many sort of points that I'd love to come at this conversation, but this is, I think, the title of your book is really interesting to me, because I think so often people like to, you know, justify, you know, something along these lines, a part in history, a time in history like this, by saying, well, they were monsters, or, you know, Hitler was a monster, or whoever, right? As if we're not them. So there's like this, they're way different than we are, right? We wouldn't behave like that. Tell me about that. Tell me what you've sort of learned about that fine line.
Yeah, well, this, you know, so that question itself with the book on Doik inflects this question in different ways, but
sure.
It also speaks, you know, it also relates directly to why did they kill and the questions I took up.
Sure.
If you go back, for example, to the trials of the Nazis immediately after what later became to be called the Holocaust, but at the time, you know, back to Nuremberg, people were concerned with crimes of aggression. But in this context, when you have the Nuremberg trials, when people were put on trial, psychoanalysis was very much in vogue, and so there were a lot of studies that came out arguing that different not surviving Nazi leaders were sociopaths, psychopaths.
Right.
And this was, so in the 1950s especially, this was a dominant mode of thinking about perpetrators. Anyway, so we might think of this as sort of a psychologically reductive explanation or psychological reductionism.
Sure.
Sort of a possible entailment. So if you say, why did it happen? All you need to say is, well, the person's crazy. The person's a sociopath. It doesn't require any sort of deep contextual understanding of the moment. So there are a variety, there are a number of these psychologically reductive explanations that float around, even now when we see, for example, with ISIS.
Mm-hmm.
When you get characterizations of ISIS, it's often, this is a barbaric regime
right.
that epitomizes the opposite of civilization.
Sure.
But again, if you think about the explanation, there's not much there. So the explanation implicit is that somehow this organization functions on a lower scale, and because they're on this more primitive scale, they somehow act on primitive impulses. But again, that's not much of an explanation. It doesn't provide much deep understanding of what's taking place. So there's another, if we talk about psychological reductionism, we might also talk about biological reductionism.
Mm-hmm.
The book Lord of the Flies as well,
sure.
where you have civilized English school children, they arrive on this island and very quickly the veneer of civilization is stripped away and they become savages, little savages, so to speak. But that, again, is this idea that there's this underlying primitive potentiality that exists that can give rise to violence. So a lot of my work has been in opposition to these kind of simplistic reductive explanations that do have power, because it's easy to label someone as evil, as a savage, as barbaric, as crazy, to give a very quick, concise explanation of what they do. But again, it misleads us, and it also leads us to view ourselves as the opposite. So we're the civilized people. We're the
right.
sane people. And Why Did They Kill? I developed a framework to try and, based on the Cambodian case, but also with an eye on other cases such as the Holocaust, the Rwandan genocide that have taken place, to try and, have a deeper understanding of what takes place and what motivates people to kill.
So tell me about the irony of all this. So you talk a great deal about the notion of difference, and really, in a sense, it's racism. And in Cambodia, it's such a weird one because it was Cambodians killing Cambodians. I mean, in a sense, you can almost understand the killing of another that's outside of your circle of reference, almost. Because, mm-hmm. Well, they're a threat and they're this and they're that. But this was a case where families were killing families and friends were killing friends and so on. But the irony of this to me is that we look at this and say, well, these people are, they're crazy or they're madmen and mad women and so on. And so what we do is we create another. And yet, isn't that exactly what the Khmer Rouge were doing in order to justify the killing that they were doing? Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. And actually, the first book takes this issue up in one way, but the book that's coming out, Manor Monster, takes up that very idea much more directly. But I recently had the experience of testifying at the Khmer Rouge Tribunal as an expert witness. At the time, they were just concluding deliberations about the charges of genocide that they have there.
Right.
And so I was in the courtroom with two of the senior Khmer Rouge leaders, Khusum Phan and Nguyen Gia, who was Pol Pot's right-hand man. I should add that Nguyen Gia more recently has been on an informal boycott, listening to the proceedings down in a holding cell.
Hmm.
But on the last day, he actually came up, sat in the courtroom, and posed a couple of questions to me. So I was there with him. But,
wow.
I stressed at the trial that it's important not to view them as monsters. They're human beings like us. They had reasons for the things they did. Again, if we talk about people as savages, as evil, sociopaths, it drives us away from the very idea that there is a sort of rationality,
right.
logic, meaning to what they're doing, and even, though it sounds counterintuitive, a moral logic.
Hmm.
So the question is also, why did they do the things that they do? If we're willing to step aside and say, well, there are certainly some sociopaths in the world, but if you look at all the Nazi leaders, if you look at all the Khmer Rouge, the odds are that that's a very small number of people.
Right,
so
right.
a lot of those people weren't sociopaths. They weren't crazy. So then what's driving them? And that's the difficult question that looking at perpetrators forces one to ask, because again, when we look at them, we begin to see them as more fully human, and we began to see ourselves as well. I was in the courtroom with them, and I'm now trying to write a little bit about this experience of, my dialogue, my interaction with Nguyen Gia, who turned the question of genocide around at me and said, was the U.S. bombing in Cambodia genocide?
Mm-hmm.
Was it war crimes?
Wow.
Yeah,
As Robert McNamara says, if we'd lost the war, we would have been tried as war criminals.
Well, yeah, so that's what he said, or was it war crimes? Clearly it most likely was war crimes. It, almost certainly wasn't genocide because it doesn't have an intent. But, I guess we're moving away from the question, which we haven't fully gotten into, about motivation.
Yes.
And why people do it. But I should just add that in the move of reversing a question, redirecting it back at me, he in effect was also engaging in a form of denial.
Right. Right.
Right. Because he no longer was the one committing genocide. So, you also have these issues where there are different ways in which, and in a court of law, and denial almost always is involved in multiple levels. So he has a very good lawyer, which is great. And they're fighting hard, even though the odds are stacked against them in many ways. There's an enormous amount of evidence. But it was a fascinating experience.
But again,
in terms of this notion of seeing a person who's often labeled as a monster, I was there 20 yards away from him,
right,
speaking to him in the courtroom. And I was grappling with this.
Sure. How can you not ask the question, how does this man sleep at night?
Yeah.
In a way. I think what I'm fascinated by is that thin veneer, the veneer of what appears to be peace. How quickly would our civilization crumble if there weren't, if the infrastructure around us crumbled as well? How willing would I be able to take someone else's life if they were getting in my way, in my family's way, and so on and so on? And I think that's one of the things for me, studying the Cambodian history has allowed me to ask some of those questions in my own life. We seem to be so willing and quick to judge, and yet we don't want to for a second dance maybe in that same, on that same dance floor, right?
Yeah, well, it goes back to the old, and this of course is a bit of a simplification, but it has a grain of truth to it, to the weirdo.
Right.
Right? Who's the weirdo at school? There's the weirdo. The weirdo's not me. Right, because I'm normal, and we band together, we normal people, against the weirdo.
Right, right.
So when we construct the other in different sorts of ways as weirdos, but also in the context of genocide, as impure threats to the body politic, as contamination, as lice, so on and so forth, we're constructing ourselves as the opposite. And so it's a sort of paradoxical situation where our positive identity is predicated on their negative identity. And you have this dyadic relationship between the perpetrator and the victim, in which each person is being constructed and identified in a certain sort of manner that creates the opposite, positive, negative. And so, again, this goes all the way from ideological broadcast down to the interactions between a torturer torturing someone in a torture chamber, right, in a cell. That's what's also going on, as a person's being tortured, forced to confess. They're being transformed in that dyadic moment into a certain sort of being, which the ideology is asserting. I think most people would say, well, I'm completely unconnected to what's taking place in a torture chamber. But in fact, in a way, it reflects, it echoes what takes place in our everyday lives, and goes back to those moments, both of calling someone else a weirdo and also being called a weirdo.
Right.
So it's with us everywhere all the time. And so I was recently giving a talk, and someone said, oh, could genocide take place in the United States here? Of course, the answer is supposed to be no. And I said, to me, genocide can take place anywhere. And I think 9/11 certainly showed how you can move in the matter of a day from a situation in which, there doesn't seem to be any possibility of genocide at all, to a situation where suddenly if you think of it in terms of a metaphor of heat, you went from a fairly hot, sort of cold water to lukewarm water that was, the temperature had risen, and suddenly Arab American, Muslim Americans, and even Sikhs in the United States were being identified, seen as different. than they were.
Yes.
You know, the people were aware of the differences, but they were stigmatized in a completely different way. So studying, you know, studying genocide brings, you know, understanding that we can't distance ourselves from those people who we like to call monsters.
Well, there has to be, it seems to me, to be able to look at this in a comprehensive way or a holistic way, there has to be a certain humility there, doesn't there? I mean, isn't that kind of what, forgive the comparison, but isn't this to some degree what reality TV is kind of based on, this idea of othering, this idea that, wow, am I ever glad I'm not like them?
Absolutely.
Right?
If we want to feel good about ourselves, one of the easiest ways to do it is to speak about someone else, think of someone else as the, you know, as having the opposite qualities. I would say Donald Trump in the U.S. with the election has done a lot of this, but I would say as well that the way colleagues, friends of mine look at Donald Trump does the same thing to him.
Mm.
You know, so it's whatever your political position, wherever you are, this sort of thing takes place all the time. So I think the humility is, in the new book that's coming out, and I mentioned this briefly at the court as well, I think of it as this sort of, it's an archaic word, but it's called effacement. But it means it's the opposite of effacement, which is to rub out the face of the other.
Okay.
But I argue for an ethical stance of effacement, that any sort of conviction has to begin with this idea of effacement.
So are you...
I worry, and I always get very nervous when I encounter sort of, I don't want to say unthinking conviction, but certainly conviction that is undertaken, that's sort of upheld in a way that doesn't allow for any type of uncertainty. Because that to me is another continuity that exists between, in our everyday lives and with what takes place in genocide, that you have these genocidal leaders, and this is, I think, very true of Nguyen Dia and Khieu Samphan and Pol Pot. I believe that they thought they were doing something good.
They were doing the right thing, and they combined with this hyper sort of communistic approach, combined with a scientific truth or access to some sort of scientific certainty, they were on the right path.
That's right. So it's the sort of conviction that's done in a way that doesn't allow for alternative possibilities, that doesn't have an openness to other points of view. So that's one of the, out of the book that's coming out, Man or Monster.
Nice.
You know, that's sort of how I end, and I sort of return back to Hannah Arendt's idea of the banality of evil, and I re-change it around a little bit, and I reframe it, readapt it as the banality of everyday thought. So that's where I land in the last page of the book, is with this idea of effacement and effacing conviction.
Can we talk?
And it's also something I brought up at the trial.
Can we talk about Emmanuel Levinas briefly?
Yeah, exactly. He's certainly someone who had a similar set of ideas.
The face speaks, and what it says is, "Thou shalt not kill." So the idea that as soon as I see you, Professor Hinton, I can't objectify you as an academic or as an intellectual or as somebody of a different skin color or hair you don't have, I don't have hair you do, et cetera, because the moment I do that, he says, is I've started to objectify you, and then I can kill you.
Yeah,
it seems like a quick leap for him, but it sounds very similar to what you're saying with this idea of effacement.
Yeah, absolutely, and he's, you know, someone as well, Arendt and Levinas, though I think he may take it one step further even.
Okay.
To a sort of, in terms of an ethical stance of where it leads, I land in the moment of the need to turn and try and see someone else.
Right.
And not just project into them to bring in my presuppositions about the world the way I think should be. Even if I encounter Nguyen Dia, if I encounter Pol Pot, to try and see them as human. Whereas I think Levinas continues on from that moment.
Yes.
To have a sort of the ethical implications are even greater in terms of the merging of the two. So I don't go quite as far as Levinas. I stop at that moment of just sort of the need to turn to the other, to try and see the person.
As a human being. Yeah, because one of the questions I wanted to ask you almost right out of the gate is, you know, why? Why do this study? Why write this book? Why go in? Is it about being a better human being? Is it about an understanding? Obviously, it's academic. It's about about research and history and all those things. But ultimately, is that a fair, I guess a fair question, but is that how you would sort of approach that, Alex? It's about becoming better humans?
Yeah, you know, again, I didn't start off with this as a concern.
Right. Yeah.
You know, I began with that question. Why did they kill? Trying to understand that. The question of what I've called effacement, the need for effacement and trying to overcome effacing conviction, that's really something that emerged. It's something I thought about in different ways, but not with those terms.
Right.
But in writing the book about Doik, you know, what Hannah Arendt, what I like about her that people often don't do nowadays is, you know, she ends and says, what is the lesson of Eichmann? What lesson can be taken out of Jerusalem? And so I wanted to do that. And so in the afterword of the book is when I sort of, you know, this idea is there throughout the book, but it really comes out in the afterword where I take up that sort of ethical question at the end. But, you know, what is, if I had to narrow it down to one lesson, and obviously there are many lessons, and, you know, you can be everyone. And academia is often critiqued for trying to make singular statements, but I made one anyways. You know, so to me, what's the lesson? It's in a context of power where you have a facing conviction that loses sight of other human beings. And so, again, so that sort of ethical position is linked to the Doik book. But it's, you know, it's something, again, I thought about that goes back further, but it really emerged in relationship to Doik. And that's where you get the title, Man or Monster.
The question
is not about answering, is he a man or is he a monster? The question is about why we label him as man or monster and what it means about us.
Right, which is great. Yeah. Which is great. Nice way to turn it on its head.
And the cover of the book is from a photograph of Doik that hangs in the Tuol Sleng Museum of Genocidal Crimes. That I had in 2009, I came across right when this trial was starting, and it had been heavily graffitied. The word evil was written across the collar of his book. So the first word in the book is actually evil. It begins with this graffitied image of Doik, and that now is the cover of the book. And the person who designed it did a nice job. They actually put the words man or monster in a sort of caption. So again, the cover of the book begins to open these questions, but the book also goes into things like torture and, you know, how Doik came to do the things he did.
I remember seeing the film S-21, the Khmer Rouge killing machine, Rithi Pan's film, and which is Doik was the leader or the, what would you call him, the director of the prison, I suppose. And in the film, he's interviewing a young guy who used to be a guard. And I'm sure you remember this scene where he asks him to kind of reenact what it would have been like inside one of the cells. And I think the young man picks up a small container or a water, a bowl, and starts to mimic as if he's hitting somebody on the head. And there was this for me, just this gut churning of how quickly this young man went from being interviewed to almost, you could see it in his face. There was almost, and maybe I'm projecting here, but it seemed like he was getting into it in a way that was deeply, deeply troubling. Do you recall that?
Yeah, no, I recall that. Rithi Pan is an amazing filmmaker. You know, if you read his stuff, he sometimes says he likes to put people in situations and see what happens.
Yeah,
and
right.
See what emerges. And so, you know, this is what emerged in that situation. Do we glean something of who he was back at that time?
Yes.
Maybe. Do we glean maybe what he thought he should be doing when he was being filmed?
Yes.
Perhaps. Who knows? Yeah. But I don't foreclose the possibility of the way you described it. That certainly is a possibility. But I go back again to this notion that I don't want to leap to a presupposition about his state of intentionality, what was in his mind, what he was doing. What I see is someone who is put in, as Rithi Pan says, put in the situation, and that's what he does. But to then say we have a sort of ahistorical time jump back into this other moment from today to then, and we're seeing exactly what happened, which is the way it's portrayed, it comes across to many people, I'm wary of that.
Yeah, sure.
Which isn't to say it's not a great film, but it's just, you know, it's, in a way, it's almost too easy. And there's a film about Nguyen Gia as well, with some people who are linked to him, where similar things come across. I mean, what do you do when you make a film? You have to edit.
You have to edit at some point.
And,
yeah.
Well, I should actually say this is another sub sort of theme in the book Manor Monster. That's what I call the redactic, but it's the fact that all of our accounts, all of our understandings of others involve erasure.
Mm.
And so, you know, it goes on when I write my book and I have lots of research material and I have to condense it down when Ritchie Pond makes his film. You know, again, it's as we talked about understanding other people in reductive manners. Well, the reason it's reductive is because it's impossible to contain the complexity of the world, and it's the way we think. And
the so caption, the caption on the newspaper should read, "All the news we think that's fit to print."
Exactly. So this is, I guess I've returned to the notion of the banality of everyday thought once again. I guess this is a problem. I've just finished this book, so it's fresh on my mind.
Yeah, sure.
But the other, you know, the other book taps in many different ways, but it's why did they kill, took up those two questions. How does genocide come to take place, and what motivates people to participate in a project of mass murder?
So I'm going to tell everyone, and I hope you'll agree, but we're going to do a part two. We're going to have to wrap this up in a few minutes, but we are absolutely going to do a part two. And Dyke, your new book is coming out is in the end of October. But can you talk a few minutes, Alex, about the notion of reconciliation, of truth and reconciliation? You know, I've spoken to many Cambodians who just wish this whole thing would go away. And I think, you know, I've lived long enough to know that it's not just going to go away. you might want to sweep it under the carpet. But so I guess the question is, are the trials helping? You know, very expensive, a lot of work, a lot of time, a lot of effort. Are we going to see a reconciled Cambodia down the road?
Yeah, you know, that's a very complicated question.
Of course.
Actually, I'm working on another book I'm finishing up, which is sort of takes.
You've got to stop writing books, Alex. Yeah.
Well, I've been gathering quite a bit of data over the last during the course of the trial.
Yeah,
so,
no kidding.
Anyway, so I have another book that I'm probably 3/4 of the way done with that takes up sort of the meaning of the trial in Cambodia.
Okay.
So it takes up these questions in different sorts of ways. Mm-hmm. You know, they're not either-or questions. And it's even a question where if you ask an individual at point A, when you talk to them, let's say 2 years later, they may answer things in a different way. And if you talk to them 3 years after that, they may have jumped back to the way they first answered a question. So, it's, you know, the idea of reconciliation, a lot of times it's spoken about as if it's this endpoint, as if there's
right.
a teleology that leads to it. But I think it's, you know, it's probably better to think of it as a process, and
right.
one that varies from person to person, from group to group, and the same person can reverse. I think it's possible that you could ask someone something, you know, even at one point in the morning, and in the afternoon they might give you a somewhat
mm-hmm.
different response.
Mm-hmm.
We don't think in a singular manner. So, you know, but if you sort of say, is there a need for a tribunal, you know, one way I always say, ask Cambodians, you know, it's their country.
That's good.
So
yeah.
that's yeah. the first thing. But I've talked to a fair number of people, and there, you know, there are differences depending on groups. I think
mm-hmm.
there's some broad differences, and, you know, I have to say it's extraordinarily difficult to generalize because
yep.
these sorts of generalizations break down almost immediately.
It's true, isn't it?
You know, so I'm even hesitant to talk about them, but, you know, you do have there some devout Buddhist who, given Buddhist conceptions of karma, sometimes will say that it doesn't really matter if you have a tribunal because they're going to suffer the consequences
right.
of their action and
right.
their rebirths.
Right, right.
Or they will say, you know, with Buddhist compassion, I pity this person for what they did. You know, that's sort of the ultimate state of compassion. It's another, this person is another human being like me. Like me, they have cravings, they have desire. They also have ways in which they're ignorant, and that ignorance can lead them to do bad things, sometimes horrible things. And when they look, you know, in Khmer, there's not an exact translation for the word evil.
Right.
Instead, it goes back to the notion of Buddhist sin, bad action, very
right.
bad action.
Right.
And so people who do these things aren't immediately labeled evil as, you know, if we go back to Doik's, the writing on Doik, right on the collar of a shirt that I mentioned, the tool slang, where someone in English has written evil, but actually if you look at the Khmer script that's also on this this image, it's using Buddhist terms often.
Right.
And Doik's eyes are scribbled out, right? And so people coming from Canada or the United States will often say, oh, he looks demonic, maybe,
right,
but like the devil.
Sure.
But what Cambodians will often say is, oh, it's a sign of ignorance, of Buddhist ignorance. His eyes are closed. They're rubbed out because he can't see. So again, so if you talk to some people sort of invoke those sorts of norms. On the other hand, I've talked to Buddhist monks who say, you know, you will have karmic justice, but there's also real world affairs, and a process of justice is part of that real world, not real world, but everyday life, as opposed to sort of religious reincarnation. And it's fine to have that. And in fact, even in Buddhist monasteries, there can be courts that are convened for infractions within the Sangha. So that's one group where some people will invoke this set of discourses. You have, in terms of geography, you know, I think in the cities, there tends to be more desire for a tribunal sometimes than in the countryside. Broadly, if people are older and live through the Khmer Rouge period, I think you have slightly higher numbers that favor a tribunal.
Right.
If you go to former Khmer Rouge zones, people will invoke notions of reconciliation much more readily.
Right.
But having said all this, if we go back, and I want to immediately sort of subvert everything I've said and say, if you also look at Cambodian history, if we go back to the 1980s, when the Cambodian government at times called for an international tribunal or some sort of tribunal, but nobody, because of the Cold War, this just wasn't going to happen, and so those calls were ignored. We got into the early 1990s in Cambodia, and the government called for reconciliation, even as the United States, which hadn't pushed a tribunal before in 1994, passed the Cambodian Genocide Act, which helped catalyze the movement for a tribunal. So again, even if you move through time, perspectives of people, players, participants change. A whole generation, kids were intensively educated about the genocide because it was part of the government's attempt to mobilize affect against the Khmer Rouge, who were still fighting during the 1980s into the early 1990s. But then when you had the Paris Peace Accord, suddenly everything shifted, and all of the lessons about this were written out of the high school text. And so then suddenly you have this generation where people were intensively educated, kids were intensively educated about, to a situation where they weren't educated at all, right? And so they began to grow up, and some of them didn't believe that this had ever taken place. And now you have the reintroduction very recently of a new book that's come about, and you have the tribunal, and it's increased awareness about the history as well. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a long, unsatisfactory answer to your question, and I guess I turn it back in the end and say, you know, we need to listen to see what Cambodians say. I've listened to what some of them have said, and they say a lot of different things.
I love though the fact that we're pretty much wrapping up the interview by this whole notion that we have to listen to Cambodians.
Absolutely.
You know, from my background in international development, et cetera, I mean, this whole notion of listening is just central. I'm just going to end us here with a quote from your book, Why People Kill. Quote, "We are all enabled and compelled by the contexts in which we live. We all have multiple motivations, and we all invest psychologically in what we do. Though we might despise them, genocidal perpetrators are meaning-making beings with complex motivations that cannot simply be explained away in terms of ideological fanaticism or obedience to authority." Close quote. It's a great quote. I mean, it pretty much ends the book, but I think it also, I hope, creates enough interest in some listeners out there so they might go out and get the book and maybe look for your new one coming up. But Alex, thank you so much for your time today. I can't believe time has flown by. It sounds like you've got two or three books in the makings. What is next for you?
Several different projects. First, let me also say thank you for taking the time, to talk to me today and to have this dialogue. It's been fascinating, and time really is passed by in a blink of an eye.
Part two for sure. Are we in agreement?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay,
so,
good.
You know, just in a nutshell, what I'm working on, I'm actually literally just working on a talk about critical thinking and genocide prevention that I'm going to present in Armenia on Saturday at a global forum. I'm writing a essay about my experience of testifying at the tribunal, and in particular my exchange with Nguyen Gia. You know, it's possible that could turn into a short book.
Sure.
I don't know. But what I need to do most immediately is to finish this other book about the tribunal and its meaning in Cambodia, hopefully by then, you know, before the end of the year. And then I will have another project on genocide prevention down the road. But
wow.
I have my hands full.
Hands are full.
Do at the moment.
Yeah, keep lots of ink in that pen.
Yes, and that for sure.
Professor Alexander Hinton, he's the director of the Center for the Study of Genocide and Human Rights and professor of anthropology and global affairs at Rutgers University, author of Why Did They Kill and Man or Monster, coming out in October. Alex, thanks again for joining us today.
Okay, thank you.